And if you haven't been around here for the past weeks, a few weeks, or you just forgot, we are in a series called The Emotionally Healthy Church. How many of you have this book, The Emotionally Healthy Church? Awesome. There's more copies out there for like the 800 of you who don't have this book. There's more copies out at the book table after the gathering. You can pick up a copy. And really what we're doing is we haven't abandoned the Bible. We're actually teaching through the Bible, and there's principles in the Emotionally Healthy Church that we're looking at kind of together with the scriptures. But really, we're not doing a new series right now. We're not doing even a season of something, of getting in touch with our feelings or anything like that. What we're doing right now as a church is we're implementing a new culture. We're implementing a culture of realizing that our spiritual health with Jesus is directly linked and tied to our emotional health with one another. And you actually cannot separate those two things. Jesus didn't, and we can't. And so really what we're doing is, for the past 2 weeks, we've been asking a few different questions. The first week, we asked the question, why? We talked about going beneath the surface in our life and the reasons why we do the things we do, why we feel the things we do, what's kind of behind the people that we are, and asking some of those difficult questions. And then last week, Bethany and John Mark talked about breaking the power of the past and how our parents and our grandparents and their sin and the way that they lived has a ton of bearing on the way that we live and our sin and how we conduct our lives. And tonight what we're talking about is the emotionally healthy trait of living in brokenness and vulnerability. The emotionally healthy trait of living in brokenness and vulnerability. And I think before we get into this, like all of us know, okay, I should be honest, I should be vulnerable. If I want to have meaningful relationships, that's like a thing that you do, right? But we don't do it. And most of the time when we know something but we don't do it, the reason is that we don't actually know it. And so tonight, in an attempt to, for us kind of collectively, myself included, to get to understand what does it mean to live in brokenness and vulnerability, in other words, what does it mean to be honest with the people around you? There's a character in the scriptures that I want to point you guys to. So go ahead, if you have your Bible, turn to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis 37. Now, if you remember, last week we talked about a guy named Jacob. What's another name for Jacob? What was Jacob's other name? Israel, right? So we talked about Jacob. We talked about Israel. How many sons did he have? 12. 12 sons that eventually become the 12 tribes of Israel. And do you guys remember a character in the scriptures named Joseph? Yeah, Joseph was he liked or hated by his father? He was liked. He was the favorite, right? His father, Jacob's life revolved around Joseph. He loved him. And it was this thing in their family that played out generation after generation after generation of favoritism of children. It was a generational sin that had been handed down from Abraham. And so Jacob had a favorite, and we learn in the scriptures that he made that very clear. And because of this, because Joseph was the favorite, his brothers were mad. The other brothers, the other 11, were so mad, in fact, that they wanted to kill Joseph. And they were about to go through with it. They were about to kill Joseph when all of a sudden, one especially creative brother got an idea. And this brother's name is Judah. And I want to look at Judah tonight as we talk about brokenness and vulnerability. Go ahead in Genesis 37, look down at verse 26, and let's read what happens. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. Now, I don't care where you grew up or who you grew up with. There's like no sibling rivalry issue that tops this one, right? Like selling your brother or selling your sister into slavery, like oops. Family drama, seriously, like this is crazy. So they're about to kill Joseph and Judah speaks up. He says, "No, I got an idea. We could make a little bit of money from this situation." And, you know, I love how he couches the idea in this kind of niceness. He says, you know, he is our own brother. He is our flesh and blood. It's like, dude, if you're so fond of his flesh and blood, why don't you, like, not sell him, right? But Joseph is sold, and Joseph's story, what's interesting, from this point on in Genesis, Joseph's story begins to kind of parallel Judah's story. And so skip over to chapter 38, Genesis chapter 38, and we're going to look at Judah's story. It's kind of this odd thing planted right in the middle of Joseph's story. Genesis 38, verse 1. At that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. So think about this for a second. In the midst of his father's grief, in the midst of this family turmoil, Joseph's gone, they faked his death, sold him into slavery. In the midst of all of this, what does Judah do? I don't care. I'm going to leave. I don't want to deal with this old man and his issues. He never loved me anyways. Judah skips town. Now, at first we go, well, yeah, maybe I'd do that too if I had a deadbeat for a dad. Like, that's pretty lame. But there's something even more intense going on here. See, where Jacob and Judah and the other brothers lived was Canaan. And Canaan was the promised land for Israel. It was the land that Abraham had been called into. And here Judah is not only leaving his family, not comforting his father, not being there for his family in this time, but he's leaving the promised land. He's leaving the place where Messiah would one day come through. He's leaving God's promise. This is a big no-no. Look at verse 2. The story continues. There, Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite woman named Shua. He married her and made love to her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Ur. She conceived and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. So Judah goes from the promised land. He leaves his family. He marries a Canaanite woman. And at first glance, we kind of look at that and go, so what? He has, you know, taste in foreign women. Like, what, is that a big deal? Well, this actually was a massive deal. This is such a big deal, in fact, that God had said, hey, don't marry outside of the family of Israel because they will turn your hearts away to their gods. In a sense, Judah is marrying an active demon worshiper, and he's directly opposing the will of God. He has no regard for his father and his father's will. He has no regard for the way that God intended marriage. And the story goes that he had two wicked sons. One son, it says he was so wicked that God put him to death. And another son, leaving behind then a woman named Tamar. So the man who is killed by God has this wife, Tamar. She's left behind after he's killed by God. And it was the other brother, Onan's duty, to then take this woman into his household and care for her. In this society, women could not fend for themselves without being attached to a family. They needed a family and a man in order to survive that world. And so it would have been Onan's family duty, his necessity to then take this woman, Tamar, into his household and to care for her as if she was his own, but he doesn't. You can read about the story on your own, but long story short, he refuses that responsibility, and God puts Onan to death as well because this is a massive infraction on God's will for women. Now skip down to verse 11. Judah then said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up, rough name, for he thought, he may die too. He's like, hey, we don't have a good track record here. He may die too, just like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's household. So Judah, and picture this. Judah says to Tamar, he says, look, things are bad. Both of my sons have been put to death by God. And so you need to just go back home and live with your father. Now, this is so offensive, so wrong in this culture. Judah, by having his sons married to her, she was then his daughter. It was his duty to have her in his household to protect and to care for her. And what is he doing instead? He's saying, you know, things are bad. Why don't you just go along? And maybe someday when my other son grows up, maybe he'll be there for you, but not right now. He disowns her. This is like as bad as having a daughter and saying, you know what, I'm kind of tired of you, so why not, we'll just see you later. Fend for yourself in the cold. This is not good. And notice that Judah places the responsibility on Tamar. Hey, you're going to have to figure it out for yourself, rather than saying, you know what, my sons were wicked, and we haven't taken care of you, and we haven't been responsible to you in the way that God has wanted for us. Now, things get even worse. Look down at verse 12. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah, to the men who were shearing his sheep, and his friend Hira, the Adullamite, went with him. So Judah's wife dies, he's grieving his wife, and he goes to a sheep shearing party. In this time, seriously, you're going to think this is awesome. In this time, when the men would shear the sheep, they'd shear the sheep, and after all their work was done, they'd kick back, they would drink. It was a massive rave party. Think like EDC in your mind. Like, that's what's going on in this moment right here. A couple months ago, we were selling my wife's car, and it's just a piece of junk. I couldn't wait to sell it. And it took us like 6 months. It was on Craigslist. I'm like, renew, renew, renew. So nobody wants to buy this car. And then randomly, I get this call from this guy. He's like, hey, dude, I got to get to Burning Man. Do you have the car? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, okay, where are you? I told him, I'm like, it's in Hillsborough. You got to go out there. So I meet him out there. He's like, dude, like, I got the call to Burning Man. Like, it's just calling me. I got to go. And I was like, yes, you do need to go, and you need this, right? Like, for all I know, this guy is somewhere stuck between here and Nevada right now. Like, I have no idea where he is, right? There's no way this car got him there. He's like, you think he can get me there? I'm like, yeah. Oops. Anyway, think that. Like, the guys get done shearing the sheep, and it's just debauchery. It's free sex, it's alcohol, it's drunkenness. It's total debauchery. Judah numbs his pain with drunkenness. That's the kind of guy that Judah is. Verse 13. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself in a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that, though Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, come, let me sleep with you. Tamar, realizing that all is lost, all hope is lost, has one last-ditch effort to get this family's attention, to be cared for. She dresses as a prostitute, and Judah wants to sleep with her. Judah's a pervert. Judah has this, he has experience. He knows where to find the prostitutes. He goes there. He knows what he's looking for. Judah is a pervert. Continuing on, skip down to verse 18. He said, what pledge should I give to you? In other words, do you take card? What credit card do you take? Do you have the square? What can I give you to tell you to basically show you that I will pay you in the future? What do you take? And she responds, your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand, she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil and put on her widow's clothes again. Judah gives the things that make him him, his staff, his cord, his seal, these things that defined him as a patriarch, as the leader of a family. He gives those to her. He's a fool. He's foolish. He trades that for sex. Verse 20. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, in order to get his pledge back from the woman. But he did not find her. He asked the men, who lived here? Where is the shrine prostitute who is beside the road at Enaim? There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here, they said. Judah thought that he was sleeping with a shrine prostitute. In this time, one of the ways that you would worship ancient deities is you would sleep with the prostitutes at their temples in order to appease the god. Judah's profane. Judah is okay with himself worshiping other gods other than Yahweh. Judah has no regard for the way of God. Verse 24. About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she's now pregnant." Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." How does that sit? Judah finds out that Tamar is pregnant. He calls her to be burned. He burns women. That's the kind of guy that Judah is. You know, the law in Leviticus chapter 22, it says that if people are found in the act of adultery, they should be stoned. Judah takes it one step further and he says, "No, we should burn her." In all of his self-righteousness. So Judah has quite a tally. Let's think about Judah for a moment. Judah is, he's a liar. Judah's a betrayer. Judah's a snake. He has no regard for God. He shirks his responsibility. He's a drunk. He's a pervert. He's profane, and he burns women. Good guy or bad guy? Pretty bad. Pretty bad. And in that moment, if you can just kind of go there for a moment, in that moment where she's there, pregnant, unmarried, Judah is declaring his own righteousness over her, lying to everyone, holding to the law, even increasing on it out of his own pride, more self-righteous than ever. You can imagine that she's there, she's been adequately roughed up, she's disheveled, and all of a sudden, the story takes a catastrophic turn. In verse 25, as she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," she said. And she added, "See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are." Oops. Bummer. I mean, this is like the news crew is there, the cameras are rolling, the whole town has turned out to judge this woman. And nobody could have scripted this. This is like more messed up than anything Job Bluth has ever done in his entire life, right? Like, this is bad. You know, he's like, "I have made a horrible mistake." Like, that's this moment, all right? He's utterly found out, utterly exposed. Now, we're going to get back to Judah, but tonight we're talking about living our lives in brokenness and vulnerability. In other words, being honest about our brokenness. And really, nothing could be further from the mind of our city. But the author of The Emotionally Healthy Church, he has this to say about that. He says, "In emotionally healthy churches, people live and lead out of brokenness and vulnerability. They understand that leadership in the kingdom of God is from the bottom up, not a grasping, controlling, or lording over others. It is leading out of failure and pain, questions, and struggles." That's what an emotionally healthy church looks like. Now, the question for us is, well, what is brokenness? What do we mean by brokenness? And Judah kind of gives us a pretty good glimpse of what brokenness actually looks like. But brokenness, if you're taking notes, write this down. Brokenness comes from the sin that happens to us, the sin that happens around us, and the sin that happens through us. What is brokenness? Sin that happens to us, around us, or through us. It's those unsightly things beneath the surface, things we'd rather not share with others. It's things that have to do with the way that we cope with our sin. It's things that we may never have had control of in the first place. It's the MC leader who's addicted to porn and isn't telling anybody about it. Brokenness is the married woman who's having an emotional affair with the barista she sees frequently. It's the college student who was abused by her father and is hurt and bitter, and her entire life is built around anger over that moment. It's the pastor who loves God but is impatient and quick-tempered. See, more often than not, the church is made up of people who would rather try to control their brokenness than reveal it. And so typically what we see in the church is we have one of three reactions to our brokenness. The first option is we flee. We flee our brokenness. Some of us avoid the unsightly parts of our lives by focusing our attention on a small portion of our life. We see this with Judah and the sheep shearing party, right? His wife dies. He says, well, that sucks. I'm going to get drunk. I'm going to sleep around. Masking and numbing the pain of his wife's death. I find myself doing this all the time, and frankly, this is what basically the entire city of Portland is built on. Life sucks. You're ashamed. Things didn't go your way. Eat more. Watch more. Spend more. Touch more. Get more. You had a bad day? There's a new restaurant out. We should go there. It'll make you better. And it better not be a chain, right? I remember being like 14 years old and being like, Mom, we're not going to a chain. Who was I? I hope I just don't have a kid like me, right? Instead of facing our brokenness, we distract or we numb ourselves with the endless supply of things, of places, of people that are right at the tips of our fingers. Another response that we have is we fight. When we see our brokenness, when it comes out or it's revealed, some of us become bitter and angry because life hasn't been fair. We pick a specific gender or race or issue to get all worked up over, taking all of our anger and hurt out there. The belief here, and maybe you're there, the belief is the world would probably be better if people were more like me. It's the feminist blogger. Hey, the 5 p.m. didn't laugh at that. It's the business manager who's mad all the time. It's the pastor who uses his power to get what he wants, when he wants, how he wants. And what makes matters worse is that when we respond this way to our brokenness, most of us are believing that our anger about the way that things are in the world is actually a righteous indignation. When in reality, the anger stems from our brokenness rather than our love for anyone or anything. See, ultimately, if this is you, you're making it your mission to make the world the way that you think it should be rather than trusting God to make the world the way that he thinks it should be. Now, the third option, and I think this is a lot of us, I know it's me, is that we hide our brokenness. We hide the unsightly things in our lives. We think that we can cover up our sin and brokenness, that life would just be better if nobody knew about it. And so we kind of curate our lives. Like an art museum has a curator, we put the best pieces of our life on display, only showing the parts that we find most acceptable. To be honest, all of social media is based on this premise. Because I was never cool, or because I'm insecure, because I need the affirmation of others. Here's my pictures. Here's how beautiful my life is. Here's the people that I know. Here's who I've been with. Here's how funny and interesting I am. Isn't it true? Here are my most important thoughts for the world to read. Like, have you ever been in that point where you're like about to post a tweet and you just like laugh because you honestly think that what you have to say is important enough for 400 plus people to read? Like, what the heck? Like, I've been there. Like, that's messed up. See, most of us treat social media with narcissism and hiding and posturing and competing and acting cooler than we actually are and faking it. And then we call it self-expression. That's silly. That's immature. That's childish. Some of us create personalities around that are fake in our lives. And then we complain that we wish that people loved the real us. But in reality, we never have shown anybody the real us because we don't think they'll like it. We never let anyone in because it's just too dangerous. And we think if we can just control and hide the unsightly parts of our lives, then we won't be exposed. We won't end up like Judah. But here's the weird part about the story of Judah. Things go well for him. After this story, things go well for Judah. And this is probably going to make you mad. But Judah gets blessed. See, at the end of his father's life, at the end of Jacob's life, he calls his sons to him and he pronounces things over them. He says, this is what your lineage and your line and your legacy is going to be like. Our words have power. And to some of the brothers, it's really gnarly. It's like, man, that's a bummer. Would hate to be that guy. And to guys like Joseph, it's good. It's a good blessing that he pronounces over them. But to Judah, oh, nobody gets a blessing like Judah. Glowing blessing about the legacy and the future that Judah is going to have. Here's what he says. Judah, your brothers will praise you. Remember back to that list? Anything praiseworthy about Judah? Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion's cub, Judah. You return from the prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? He's untouchable. He's unstoppable. He's ferocious. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nation shall be his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. Judah gets that blessing. Is that fair? Because you got to be thinking about Joseph at this point. See, their stories parallel one another, and that's not on accident. Joseph's story is one of innocence. Really, there's no sin recorded of Joseph's life in the entire story. He saves Egypt and the known world at the time through a famine. When he's confronted with a woman who wants to sleep with him, he runs away from her. He endures, he perseveres, he trusts God. And Judah gets that kind of blessing. What the heck? Is that fair to bless a snake like Judah and not bless a righteous man like Joseph? And I don't know about you, but this line here, it just bugs me. It says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of the nation shall be his. Who is he talking about? That's about the Messiah. That's messianic. He's saying that, look, Judah, through your line, that's where the Messiah is coming through. And sure enough, you get to Matthew chapter 1, the narrative of Jesus. In the first chapter, there's a long list of connecting the dots between Abraham and Jesus, and guess who's in his lineage? Judah. Yuck. Gross. That kind of guy's in the lineage of Christ. And some of you already thought you had enough ammo against God, right? But hang on a moment. Before you ditch the Bible, go back to that moment where Judah's there with Tamar in front of him. Her sin's been exposed. She's pregnant and she's unmarried. In that same moment when Judah is found out, he doesn't hide. He doesn't flee. He doesn't fight. Judah gets real honest. Judah gets real vulnerable about himself. Check out what he says. Judah recognized them, and he said, she is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son, Shelah, and he did not sleep with her again. She is more righteous than I. Totally lowered, totally humiliated. He even confesses things he wasn't accused of. Look at this. He says, she's more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son, Shelah. I didn't even follow what I was supposed to do. I didn't even take her into my home. Yeah, I slept with her, and I shouldn't have. And to make matters worse, I haven't cared for her the entire time she's been with my family. I'm wrong. He puts himself on the stake and exposes his own wickedness. And what he is saying is this. He's saying, I should be the one burned, not her. Let me be burned, not her. See, Judah gets real honest about who he is and what he deserves. And then in the coming narrative, he gets real honest about who God is. You see, the story of Judah is this weird thing. It's like right in the middle of the story of Joseph. And yet, after Genesis 38, the rest of the Joseph narrative, there's this new character that you start seeing his name all over the place, and it's Judah. Whenever Joseph's brothers are mentioned, it always phrases it this way. Judah and his brothers went there. Judah and his brothers did this. Judah and his brothers went before Pharaoh. Judah and his brothers went there. The author of Genesis is trying to tell us that Judah's become a leader, that Judah has changed. Why? How? Because Judah got honest about who he was, and Judah grew because of it. See, when the brothers go to Egypt to get food to save them from the famine, it's Judah who promises his father, he says, I'll take the blame if anything happens to Benjamin, the youngest son, the new favorite. If anything happens to Benjamin, let the blame be on me. And so then when later on in the story, they're before Joseph and they're in trouble and Benjamin's life is at risk of being thrown into an Egyptian prison. What does Judah do? He says, let me be thrown into the prison instead of Benjamin. Let me take his place. Let the punishment of him be on me. Radically different than, remember, like 180 degree difference than selling his brother into slavery. Instead, Judah has grown. The character development has taken place, and he's there saying, let the hurt be on me so that Benjamin can go free. Not only has Judah been honest about his sin and been vulnerable about his brokenness, but Judah starts acting differently. Rather than selling his brother, he promises his own hurt for the preservation of his brother. And so why did Judah get the blessing? Why did he get a pronouncement that the scepter will never leave his lineage? Why did he get this kingly blessing? Because Judah acted like Christ. Judah acted like Christ, dying for his brother, stepping into his place, taking the blame that was meant for someone else on himself. What does that remind us of? Jesus substituting for us, taking the punishment that we deserved for our wickedness. And so in the end, Judah turns out to be an example of honesty, of forgiveness, and courage. So what does this look like for us? What do we learn from Judah? What do we learn from his example? I think we learn two things, and we'll end with this. The first thing we learn is that brokenness kept inside destroys you. Brokenness kept inside destroys you. When you keep your sin and your brokenness a secret, it suffocates you. The entire narrative of Judah's life is essentially like one bad decision after another. He's hurt over his father's favoritism. He's running from his pain. He's masking it. He's getting angry about it. He's hurting others because of it. And it just keeps snowballing and growing over and over. And yet you have to understand that Judah's not acting randomly. Judah believes that this is just who he is. See, when you believe that something's true about yourself, you tend to live that out. So whatever you believe about yourself, that's how you will begin to live. Judah believed he was worthless. Judah believed that his dad didn't love him. Judah got angry because of that, because ultimately behind every piece of anger, there's a massive piece of hurt. Judah was really hurt. He sold his brother into slavery. It didn't fix the issue, so he left home. He fled the brokenness. He began to do things he said he would never do, but the pain was just too visceral. See, so often what holds us in our brokenness is our shame about it. Shame is when you start believing that what you do or have done defines who you are. Your brokenness begins to dictate your way of life. I'm worthless. I need people to give me worth. I need your affirmation. I'll do anything for it. Anything that you need, I'll do it. I just need you to like me. I need your affirmation because deep down, I believe I'm worthless. I'm dumb. I'm not smart. I'm not intelligent. So I'm going to hold my opinion back. People think I'm shy, but in reality, I'd rather have friends than express who I am. I'm bad. I'm trouble. I've always been trouble. It's what I've always heard. And I'm just going to be bad, and I'm just going to be trouble because some people just never change. See, when we keep the way that we really feel and the brokenness that's really true about us from our friends and from God, it kills us. It forms us into worse versions of ourselves. David has this to say about this very thing in his life, keeping his sin from people. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away. Through my groaning all day long, for day and night your hand was heavy on me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. To hold in your sin is dehumanizing. It's exhausting. It's draining. You never become who you want to be if that's how you live. But what we learn from Judah is that when you get vulnerable, you get to become you. When you get honest, you get to become you. When your fears and your brokenness and your thoughts and your hopes and your dreams are all out on the table, then you get loved for who you are, not a mirage that you've worked up, thinking that people would like me more if I was just like fill in the blank. And unless you start in that place of honesty, you will never grow into the kind of person you want to be. You will never be courageous. You'll never be kind. You'll never be peaceful or calm or confident or humble. All of that begins with honesty about this is who I really am. And so our job, here's like the call for us from this first point. Our job is to create a safe place for people to come out of hiding. A place so ruled by grace that anyone can be honest. And that doesn't mean that there's not consequences for your sin. That doesn't mean that when you get honest about who you are, there won't be ramifications to that. But what that means is that when you get honest in a community of grace, you're going to grow if you stick with it. You're going to grow just like Judah grew. And so our job as a church is to make church a place for Judas, to make our missional communities places for Judas, which really leads me to my next point, and that's this, that grace empowers us. Grace empowers us. See, it matters where and with whom you get vulnerable. How many of you have ever grown up and you've had that situation where you get honest about who you are and you get the smirk? Or somebody rolls their eyes. Here we go again. Or somebody purses their lips. Painful messages reminding us that we better be good. We better be like everyone else if we want to be in. And so people tend to move in one of two extremes in life. We do one of two things. We either control our brokenness. I'm going to flee from it. I'm going to hide it. I'm going to fight. Or we flaunt it. This is just who I am. So in one scenario, you have the people who say, I'm just going to keep it a secret, my sadness, my sin, my thoughts, my feelings, my weaknesses. I don't really want anybody to know that because I just want to be accepted. And then you have, on the other side of things, you have the person who says, this is just who I am, so deal with it. I got my desires. I have the things that I want to do. This is just me, and I'm not going to change, and I don't care. And I'm actually going to find a crew of people that will accept me for me, unlike you guys. But see, if you respond either of those two ways, what you show is that you don't actually understand the gospel. See, we don't get the kind of grace that God approaches our brokenness with if we respond either of those two ways. We actually don't believe it. See, the gospel isn't legalism. Hey, shape up or else. Fall in line or else. And the gospel isn't relativism. I'm not going to hold you to a standard of life abundant. You just do you. I'm going to do me. What's good for you is good for you. What's good for me is good for me. No, no, no. The gospel is humble yourself and be honest that there are things in your life that are not right. That the wages of your sin is death. But at the very same time, in the very same breath, realize just how loved you are. Loved enough that God would pay those wages so that you could have life. Do you see what, when you understand the gospel like that, do you see what that does for you? It gives you humility and self-worth. Yeah, you're right. There's some really messed up things in my life, and the wages of my sin, it's death. But do you see the self-worth? I'm delighted in by the creator of everything. In fact, the creator of everything came and paid the wages, paid for my sin, so that I could actually be worth something. Oh, it's humility and self-worth. Do you see that? Francis Spufford, one of my new favorite authors from the UK, he's a science fiction author, but he also writes about Jesus. He says this: if you won't hear the bad news about yourself, you can't know yourself. You condemn yourself to the maintenance of an exhausting illusion, a false front to yourself which keeps out doubt and with it hope, change, nourishment, breath, life. If you won't hear the bad news, you can't begin to hear the good news about yourself. Think about that. Where does it begin? Same for Judas, same for us. It begins with honesty. See, we have to become a church of brokenness, which is, yeah, there's things that are not right, and vulnerability. And I'm honest about that. And I'm honest about the gospel. Humility and self-worth. Do you have that? Do you have that kind of humility? Do you have that kind of worth in your life? Because I can't believe that I'm saying this, but honestly, Jesus is looking for people who are like Judah. Jesus is looking for people who are like Judah because the people who are like Judah actually need him. Do you need him? Have you been honest enough to realize that you need him again? 5 years later, 10 years later, 2 months later. So where do we begin with this? How does this get practical? Because this is hard, right? Being honest is not fun. It's difficult. I think that the ground zero for all of us is just getting honest with God. Getting honest with God. Tell him how you feel in every single situation. This is like so practical. Tell him how you feel in every situation. Tell him about your anger. Why are you angry? Tell him about your lust. What are you lusting after? Tell him about your fears. Tell him about your hopes. Tell him about your dreams. Just bring it to him. Say, you know, I can't shape up. You've never asked me to shape up. This is just who I am. I'm humbled by that, God. I want to grow. I have hopes for my life. I want to become like you, Jesus. But honestly, this is where I'm at right now. That's our beginning place. And that's actually where grace steps in. See, you guys all know the story of Amazing Grace, the song, right? Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Written by John Newton, who was do you drive a ship? Commanded a ship. He was like a slaver, all right? So he was a bad dude. He had a ship that he would, you know, slave with. So I'm like, what do you even call that? It's just bad. So John Newton had this horrible life, and then he writes this song, Amazing Grace, and you just go, oh, how this man understands grace. To go from slavery and putting people into slavery to understanding, you know, grace and God's freedom. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved, yes, even a wretch like John Newton. Powerful, right? But there's a little bump in the road in that narrative, and that's this. That John Newton wrote Amazing Grace before he gave up slaving. Awkward. Right? I mean, that's like the Nazi SS who feels guilty for cheating his friends while playing poker. Like, kind of missing the mark, right, man? Like, ooh. But here's the thing. Here's the thing about the gospel. When you get honest about your brokenness, John Newton sitting there going, I need to give up my gambling. I need to give up my drinking. And it's God's grace that's revealing this to me. When you even give him that much, when you give him just an inch, God takes a mile. When you get honest just initially about, hey, this is who I am, oh, the amazingness of grace that you're going to experience. The beauty, the unsearchable realms of grace that God has for you. See, as you open up just even a little bit of your life, God comes in. He's like the dentist. You've given him an inch, he'll take a mile. That's C.S. Lewis. He'll come in and he'll slowly begin to change your entire life from to the very core of who you are. You give him even just a little bit of your brokenness, and sooner or later you will find out just how amazing grace is. And slowly, slowly, as you get vulnerable, you become like Judah. You begin to change. And God begins to do things in your life and make you courageous and give you a humility and a self-worth that you never thought you could have. And I remember this getting very real for me when I was 19. I didn't really follow Jesus throughout my high school years. I kind of like my parents did, and they were awesome. But church was just so lame and dumb. Maybe you've been there, but I just hated it, to be honest. And so I just said, whatever the church is doing, I just want to do the opposite of that. Like, that's kind of like how I did life. And so when I was 17 years old, I was dating this girl, and she wanted to start having sex, and I said, okay, my parents wouldn't want me to do this, but I'm going to do it. And so I remember when I was 19 years old, having come to Jesus shortly after that relationship and the brokenness of that relationship driving me to the foot of the cross. I remember being 19 years old and sitting in my room. I was still living at home. And I remember, you know, my parents, they are so awesome people. They're amazing. But they had put a little incentive in front of me. They said, listen, Alex, if you are a virgin by your wedding day, we have some incentive for you. It's kind of like, I was like, I'm not wearing a purity ring. So they're like, we'll give you money if you can make it. And don't judge them. I know all of you are judging them right now, but they're good parents. They're actually amazing parents. They're like, I love them so much. And so I remember being 19 years old and God talking to me while I'm sitting on my couch in my room. And he said, Alex, do you want to be humble and honest and courageous, or do you want money? And I said, I want to be humble, honest, and courageous. And he said, then you need to get honest about your brokenness with your parents. I'll never forget it. I walked over to their room. I was so nervous, but I felt like I have to do this. This is the courageous thing. This is what humility and self-worth gives me. I got to step out in courage. And I walked into my parents' room and I said, you don't know me, and this is me. This is my brokenness, and I know it's going to cost me whatever. I don't care. I would rather be a humble, honest, courageous man than have any amount of money. And so the question that I have for you tonight is, who do you need to talk to? Yeah, we went there. Like, who do you need to get honest with about your brokenness? Where are you masking it? Is it your social media account? You can't have community. Like, give me a break. There's no community there. People don't know you. No. That's lying to yourself. Who do you, real life, need to get vulnerable with? Do you want to grow? Do you want to become more like Jesus? Have you allowed grace to come and to touch your heart? Do you understand it? So here's some questions that I have for you, but do you understand the grace of God? Do you understand the gospel? Do you understand that you approach him and that he has grace for you, no matter what you've done? Do you get that? Do you have anyone in your life that you can be totally and completely honest with? Can you be honest with your spouse? Do you have a missional community that you can be honest with? Are there people who really know you? We work so hard to make it so that people don't get to see the unsightly things, when in reality, we want nothing more than to be truly all the way down known. And the first step, if that's what you really want, the first step is showing ourselves the same amount of grace that God shows us, and then showing that same amount of grace to everyone else. And when we do that as a church, we will become a place for people like Judah, for people that Jesus is looking for, because those are the people who need him. Let's pray.